The Supreme Lord, the Personality of Godhead, although the Lord of all followers of different paths of self-realization, is knowable only by those who are above all pretensions. Everyone is searching for eternal peace or eternal life, and with an aim to this destination, everyone is either studying the Vedic scripture or other religious scriptures, or undergoing severe austerity as empiric philosophers, as mystic yogis, or as unalloyed devotees, etc. But the Supreme Lord is perfectly realized only by the devotees, because they are above all pretensions. Those who are on the path of self-realization are generally classified as karmis, jnanis, yogis, or devotees of the Lord. The karmis, who are much attracted by the fruitive activities of the Vedic ritual, are called bhukti karmi, or those who desire material enjoyment. The jnanis, who try to become one with the Supreme by mental speculation, are called mukti karmi, or those who desire liberation from material existence. The mystic yogis, who practice different types of austerities for attainment of 8 kinds of material perfection, and who ultimately meet the Supersoul, Paramatma, in trance, are called siddhi karmi, or those who desire the perfection of becoming finer than the finest, becoming heavier than the heaviest, getting everything desired, having control over everyone, creating everything liked, etc. All these are abilities of a powerful yogi. But the devotees of the Lord do not want anything like that for self-satisfaction. They want only to serve the Lord, because the Lord is great, and as living entities, they are eternally subordinate parts and parcels of the Lord. This perfect realization of the self by the devotees helps him to become desireless, to desire nothing for his personal self, and thus the devotees are called niskami, without any desire. A living entity, by his constitutional position, cannot be void of all desires. The bhukti kami, mukti kami, and siddhi kami all desire something for personal satisfaction. But the niskami devotees of the Lord desire everything for the satisfaction of the Lord. They are completely dependent on the orders of the Lord, and are always ready to discharge their duty for the satisfaction of the Lord. In the beginning, Arjuna placed himself as one of those who desire self-satisfaction, for he desired not to fight in the battle of Kurukshetra, but to make him desireless, the Lord preached the Bhagavad Gita, in which the ways of Karma Yoga, Jnana Yoga, Hatha Yoga, and also Bhakti Yoga were explained. Because Arjuna was without any pretension, he changed his decision and satisfied the Lord by agreeing to fight. Karishye vachanam tava. And thus he became desireless. The examples of Brahma and Lord Shiva are specifically cited here because Brahmaji, Lord Shiva, Shrimati Lakshmiji, and the 4 Kumaras, Sanaka, Sanatana, etc., are leaders of the 4 desireless Vaishnava Sampradayas. They are all freed from all pretension. Srila Jiva Goswami interprets the word gata vyalikae as prujita kaitavo, or those who are freed from all pretensions, the unalloyed devotees only. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Madhya 1949, it is said, Krishna bhakta niskama ata eva shanta bhukti mukti siddhi kami sakhri ashanta. Those who are after fruit of result for their pious activities, those who desire salvation and identify with the Supreme, and those who desire material perfections of mystic power, are all restless because they want something for themselves. But the devotee is completely peaceful because he has no demand for himself and is always ready to serve the desire of the Lord. The conclusion is therefore that the Lord is for everyone, because no one can achieve the result of his respective desires without his sanction. But as stated by the Lord in the Bhagavad Gita 8.9, all such results are rewarded by Him only, for the Lord is Adiswara, the original controller of everyone, namely the Vedantists, the great Karmakandas, the great religious leaders, the great performers of austerity, and all who are striving for spiritual advancement. But ultimately He is realized by the pretensionless devotees only. Therefore special stress is given to the devotional service of the Lord by Srila Sukadeva Goswami. He is the super soul and the supreme lord of all self-realized souls. He is the personification of the Vedas, religious scriptures and austerities. He is worshipped by Lord Brahma and Shiva and all those who are transcendental to all pretensions, being so revered with awe and veneration. May that supreme absolute be pleased with me. Srila Prabhupada highlights the word gata vyalikai, gata vyalikai, in the word for word. Let me just find it for where are we here? By those who are above all pretensions, he says. Gata is goal, and vyalikai, I would have to look up in the dictionary. Srila Jiva Goswami interprets the word gata vyalikai as prujita kaitala, as relating to cheating religions. Earlier in the Bhagavatam, we find that in the second verse of Bhagavatam, that point established that there are cheating religions, worshipping demigods for temporary benefits, or worshipping the impersonal Brahman as the ultimate source of everything, not understanding actually that Brahman is only a part of the manifestation of the Absolute Truth. And as it is explained in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, that Shakti Parinamavat, that actually the Brahman or the Brahma Jyoti, the effulgence of Krishna's body, is an energy of Krishna. And therefore, Sankaracharya is wrong when he states that Brahman cannot transform, because Brahman is the Absolute. So no, Brahman is part of the Absolute, as the energy of the Absolute, thus it is the Shakti, and thus Shakti Parinamavat. It can produce byproducts and can transform. And thus, Shankaracharya's philosophy that the material energy is false doesn't stand. And Bhagavatam, in the first verse, is making that point. Basically, that everything originates in the Supreme Lord, and the Supreme Lord, he is all-knowing, he is fully aware of everything, and yet independent from it, Swarat. So in this way we see that there is Krishna, and also byproducts manifesting of Krishna, which points at Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, being also the origin of Brahman. The Muktikami, the one who is searching for liberation, the jnani, he is kami, or he is still having lusty desires, still personal desires, because he is looking to be relieved from material existence. He is looking for liberation. He is looking to become free from material suffering, from the different types of klesh, adhyatmika, adhibhautika, adhidaivika klesh, suffering from own body and mind, suffering from other living beings, suffering from natural circumstances controlled by the devas, by the demigods. All these kinds of suffering are making material life difficult at all times. And actually, one who is in knowledge can see that such suffering is present, sometimes in the foreground, sometimes in the background. But in material existence, such suffering is there. Therefore, the jnani is in that sense enlightened, that he has understood that the goal of life is beyond this material world. But then he does not understand actually the nature of the material world. It is described that there are two paths leading to knowledge. One is the Aroha Panta, the other one is the Avaroha Panta. The Aroha Panta is the ascending path, and the Avaroha Panta, the descending path. Ascending path means that by dint of our own intellectual capacity or any other capacity, some philosophers are also using intuition, but by dint of our own capacity that we're trying to capture the absolute truth. And that, of course, is denied in the Brahma Samhita, Pantastu Koti Satavatsara Sampragamyo Vayoradhapi Manaso Munipum Levanam. Even by traveling at the speed of mind, one can never touch the tip of the toe of the Lord. Such speculation of the jnanis can have a great effect. We can, for example, when we are looking at Western history and Western philosophy, we see a lot of speculation. We look at Platonian philosophy and we see that Plato has a concept of the soul where he ascribes reasoning as a quality of the soul. He doesn't see the intelligence as being separate. He has no understanding that the intelligence is part of the subtle body, and thus he sees that ability as a feature of the soul. He also sees that the appetite to enjoy in this world is driven by the soul, whereas in the philosophy of Krishna consciousness, we understand that the living being is by nature anandamay vyasat, by nature pleasure seeking, and that is a quality of the soul. However, by the time that it comes to the material energy, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur explains, the soul enters into a dormant state, and is lending the energy to the mind, which then steals thinking, feeling, and willing, which are the original functions of the soul, and is in that way trying to enjoy the material energy. Plato doesn't quite get it, you know, that the soul is not directly involved in enjoying the material energy. If we look further, I was looking at definitions of the soul and how different Western philosophers saw the soul, and then you go to Saint Augustine, who is like one of the founding theologians and philosophers of Christian faith, and he makes the distinction between plant souls, animal souls, and human souls. And how much misery have we seen from that? How much suffering have animals gone through? Whereas some idea has developed that the soul of the animals is not really a soul. It's some sort of biological soul, but it's not eternal. Right? Only human souls are then given qualities of eternal, and we have a great philosophy which justifies what goes on the plate of the Yavana culture, the meat-eating culture. So, in this way we can see what damage jnanis can do. We can see that that Augustine, although a sincere believer, that his philosophy was mixed with jnana, mixed with speculation, and he was borrowing from Plato. And we can see that in the end, that it justifies atrocious activity, which brings so much misery to the world, the endless animal slaughter going on. I mean, billions, actually, something, if I remember it correct, something like 3 billion animals a year being slaughtered. So that's a serious number. I mean, that's, in a few years, as much as the whole world population. So just to give a perspective of how jnanis with speculation, being brilliant personalities, being very intelligent, but relying too much on that intelligence, becoming intoxicated. Srila Prabhupada was explaining in a lecture that when people get some opulence, either wealth or learning, it's intoxicating. Suddenly they get recognition, they become important, whatever they think is very significant. And as a result, they develop attachment to this adoration. And thus, the jnanis get great public recognition. As examples, you know, Plato during his life was known as a great, great philosopher and very... very much revered. He had a school of philosophy. Augustine became even in his life was getting a lot of recognition. And thus, it's intoxicating. Gyan is intoxicating. And thus, wealthy people, learned people, very beautiful people become intoxicated. Beautiful ladies are sometimes known as being out to kill, right? And conquering men and wrapping them around the finger, chew them up, spit them out, and next, right? And it's the power of that beauty, right? They enjoy the power of their beauty they have over men. It's intoxicating. It's very intoxicating. And in this way, we see, Kunti Devi says, Janmaishwarya Shruta Shibir Eidamana Madapumam Nagarati Agudautam Vaitvamma Kinshana Gocharam. One must be exhausted with this intoxication. With this intoxication of my birth, my aristocratic birth. Or Aishwarya, my wealth. Yes. Shruta, my learning or my beauty. All these intoxicating elements, one must become exhausted with that intoxication. Otherwise, one remains a bhukti, a mukti, or even a siddhi. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita, we also have a description of an astrologer who comes upon a poor man, and that poor man is told by the astrologer, actually you are not poor at all, you are not poor, your father was very rich, but your father died in a foreign land, your father left a great treasure for you, but he could not tell you. However, you can find this treasure if you very carefully follow these instructions. Said, if you dig towards the north, you must be very, very careful, because there is a big black snake there which will devour you. If you dig towards the west, beware, beware, there is a ghost, and that ghost will haunt you. If you dig to the south, there will be wasps. There will be wasps and drones in the south that will sting you. So don't dig to the south either. But if you dig to the east, you will easily find the treasure. That allegorical story is representing this point about the karmi, the jnani, and the yogi. In the north, the big black snake, in the north so many yogis enter into the Himalayas trying to get mystic powers. And of course, these mystic powers place them above other men. They give them all kinds of powers over others. Some are mentioned here. As those who desire the perfection of becoming finer than the finest, lagima, by which we can even travel on the sun rays, or become very small and enter in between the atoms, and things like this, where one can manifest things by mystic power according to the laws of nature. And one can do many things. Prakamya, and then I think it's Kamayavista, where you can do things against the powers of nature. These mystic perfections are further described in the 11th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, and very elaborately. And there it is described how there are different mystic powers that arise from different modes of nature. And then the mystic powers that derive from the lower modes of nature, from ignorance, are worshipping ghosts, spirits, and such dark beings, and bring witchcraft and all these kind of things, which are indeed possible, and so on. It is said that though the powers that arise from the mode of passion are stronger than the ones from the mode of ignorance, and that the powers that arise from the mode of goodness are the ultimate power. What to speak of, or are greater, I should rather say, than the other two. The ultimate power, of course, comes from the Supreme One. And therefore, the Vaishnavas, in that sense, because they are protected by the Supreme Lord, are possessing the greatest mystic power, not necessarily of their own, but the Supreme Lord. And whether the Supreme Lord will lend the mystic power directly to the Vaishnava, or whether the Lord will interfere, that is another matter. But ultimately, when the Supreme Lord interferes, then everything is under control. A Vaishnava is described as one who is not pretentious. He is not pretentious to present himself as anything more than he is. He's very humble. He is described as sadhava. Sadhava is described in the Bhagavatam, is translated as thoroughly honest. So he is thoroughly honest. And when we become thoroughly honest, then we immediately have to realize that we are very minute controllers. We have some control over things, but not very far-reaching. And we very quickly come to the limits of our control. And then we realize that so many things are going on that are not being controlled by me. Therefore, there must be greater controllers, or a greater controller than myself. And thus, we see that a Vaishnava is also using logic, just as the Jnani uses logic, trying to understand the absolute truth. But the Vaishnava receives transcendental knowledge from a higher source, coming through the cyclic succession, and then uses logic in trying to understand how this is all true. Otherwise, we become parrots. We just sit like parrots, repeating knowledge, memorizing it, and just repeating it. Like children sometimes can, on Jamashtami or other festivals, very nicely recite verses. And it's impressive how well they can remember. And it's very good. But they're not yet able to fully grasp the meaning of the verses and to actually see how it is true. So in this way, a devotee must be thoroughly honest, thoroughly understand how this philosophy of Krishna consciousness is true. It's not, oh, we're following a descending process, every comes down from the Supreme Lord, so no more work to do. All the work has been done. I just have to sit and be dull and just hear the Bhagavatam, and that's the process. But now we have to make it our own. We have to take the Bhagavatam and make it our own, understanding how it is true and in every aspect. And here, in this particular section of the Bhagavatam, we deal with the process of creation. Now, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in the Chaitanya Bhagavat mentions that the Bhagavatam at the beginning, at the end, and in the middle is all describing the process of devotional service. So when we are looking at devotional service, then, first of all, there is Krishna. There's no devotional service without Krishna. Devotional service is dedicated to Krishna. And therefore, Krishna is the center of every aspect in the Bhagavatam. So when we are discussing the process of creation, then Krishna is also the center. And we can see how everything is emanating from Krishna. There are two levels of creation, Sarga and Visarga, or the primary creation done by Lord Vishnu, the secondary creation coming from by Lord Brahma, who finds himself in the universe on the lotus and who is looking for his origin and then gets the message, tapa, two syllables, perform austerity, which is his beginning towards pure devotional service. He is performing austerity for the purpose of knowing the truth. Therefore, it is the beginning of his humility. He's not performing austerity for any other purpose than to really find the truth. And therefore, Lord Brahma is the suitable candidate for receiving the knowledge of the Supreme Lord, because he has no pretensions when he's performing his austerity. And in that way, knowledge comes down into this universe through Lord Brahma to Narada, to Vyas, and on to the more modern Acharyas, Madhvacharya and Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and all our present Vaishnava Acharyas. So in this way, we receive transcendental knowledge. And then we begin to live this transcendental knowledge. And we thoroughly try to understand this transcendental knowledge. It can make a big difference. In Vrindavan, just behind the Krishna Balaram Mandir, there is one ashram which chants a mantra, which I will not even speak because I don't want to put it in anyone's head. But it is a mantra that contains the names of Nitai, Gaur, and also Radhesham, and so on. And if you stay in the guest house, you know, in the rooms, anywhere from like number 13 to number 8, you're getting full blast. Right? Do not stay in those rooms if you can avoid. I was the manager of that building. I know very well how loud it is in those rooms. Anyway, but sometimes they get very ecstatic. Very ecstatic. And what is wrong with chanting the names of Nitai Gaur? What is wrong with chanting the names of Radhesham? No, very nice to chant the names of the Lord. But of course, when we chant the names in the Maha Mantra, then not only are the various names in the Maha Mantra each names of the Lord and of his Shakti, right? But there is also an intimate relationship between these names. One can say in one translation of the Maha Mantra that Krishna means the all-attractive Supreme Lord. You can say that Hare refers to Srimati Radharani, to devotional service. And Ram, Ramanti Yogino Nante Satchananda Chidatmani, refers to the transcendental happiness, which is the result of that devotional service to Krishna. In this way, we can translate the Maha Mantra and see how there's a relationship between the various names in the Maha Mantra. So they chant just names of the Lord, good names, yeah, all good names, but not in that relationship. So their mantra is inferior to the Maha Mantra, but that's not the only problem with that ashram. They get very ecstatic. They chant Nitai Gaur, very Nitai Gaur, and they get into it. But one thing they are missing, the proper understanding of who Nitai Gaur actually are, because they say, yes, Gaur, Gauranga, yes, he is Krishna. They got that one. And then Nityananda, they say, Radharani. That's a little bit off, right? Unfortunately, missed the boat by a few miles, so to speak. And that changed everything. Right? So, of course, there's still benefit from chanting these names. That is absolutely a fact. But if the tattva is not there, if the proper philosophical understanding is not there, one can see that it can have quite disastrous effects. I mean, speculation enters, big changes can occur, and so on. And thus, the philosophy of Srimad Bhagavatam is putting everything in perspective. Since here we are discussing the process of creation, is putting the material energy into perspective in its relationship with the Supreme Lord, who is the origin of the material energy, who is also still with the material energy as it is manifest. Right? And when the material energy winds up, it returns into his body. And in this way, we can see that the Supreme Lord is connected to this material energy at all times. And yet, as we read in the Bhagavad Gita, he is seated in the heart as if neutral. As if neutral. He is not interfering with this material energy. As if neutral. Right? Although he is described as Maya Jakshena Prakite Suyate Sacharacharam, he doesn't, everything goes on by his will and his desire. He's not involved. He leaves it all simply to the laws of material nature. So, it is said the Lord is seated in Bhagavad Gita, it is mentioned Krishna is sitting in the heart as if he is neutral. As if. As though neutral, actually, it says. As though neutral. But he is not neutral, because he is very eager to see all the living beings coming back to their constitutional position, to their original position of knowledge. And again, resume devotional service. Therefore, although we reject the process of jnana, the process of speculation, we do need transcendental knowledge, and we do need to try and think, how is this knowledge true? And one thing that these Bhagavatam lectures do is that they refine our understanding. One reason why it is good to hear from different speakers, because you get like a little bit of a different angle, right, on a different point. And again we hear the same knowledge. We read this knowledge, but then we hear an explanation a little from a little different angle than we understood it. And in this way, gradually, in these discussions on Bhagavatam, our knowledge of this absolute truth is becoming more and more refined. And that is the idea. And with it, we understand how to serve and who to serve. Then we still have to serve. We still have to translate what we hear into action. One quality of the soul that is described in Vaishnava philosophy, Bhagavad Gita, is that the soul is always active. And therefore, one must be always active. And one who is not active is still missing the point. It must translate into active service. Of course, some brahmanas can preoccupy themselves just with philosophy all day and make it their service to explain that philosophy. Most of us need to, after hearing Bhagavatam, need to do something practical, engaging also the senses, the mind, in engaging the material energy in the service of Krishna. So it's important that ultimately we take shelter of devotional service. Then we understand the purpose of creation. How can one understand the process of creation without understanding the purpose of creation? So, with that, I will end. And if there's any question or comment,
then. This one small point that you talked about the people behind the guest house and just that whole idea of people who are chanting. But not properly, with improper understanding,
yes,
mood and so on. I think it's Sanatan Goswami and Hari Bhakti Vilas quotes the one verse which ends Sarpachishtayatapaya, that such chanting, it may be like milk touched by the lips of a serpent. Uchishta means remnants. So the remnants of a snake. Because the thing is, the milk is milk, but now something has been added to it, which is poisonous.
Right.
So the poison kills you. So it's like some part of those people, their consciousness becomes attached to the chanting. Just like, we should hear chanting from the lips of a pure devotee, that's stated.
True.
Because some sort of aspect or part of the pure devotee has become involved in the chanting, or Mahaprasad, due to being touched by the lips of the great devotee. Even though it's prasad, it becomes even greater.
Right.
So somehow there's some process of things, depending on who we get whatever it is from, that part of them becomes attached to us, to it, and then that has whatever effect it may.
Yeah. Sravanam navakai davyam. One should not hear. It's our duty not to hear. And then when we're forced to hear, well, then we just pray for protection from that kind of... It's not that there's no toxic effect, right? But we are constantly praying for protection from all kinds of toxic effects. As we're here in the outside of the Dham, we hear all kinds of mundane sounds and see all kinds of mundane pictures, which are also intoxicating, toxic. So we are praying for protection. And when we come to especially places where spirituality is in the foreground, like in the Holy Dham or in the Kumbh Mela or something like that, then you have to hear so many things. Like the Kumbh Mela, I can't imagine that once upon a time, before they invented speakers, that Kumbh Melas were nice. Nowadays, Kumbh Melas, they have these Indian horn speakers, which are so loud, and they echo and everything, and everyone is chanting his mantra there, everyone, and it's at blast volume, and it's like, it's 24 hours blasting, and it's just like, try not to hear that. But we go to Kumbh Mela. Right? We are not hiding under a blanket, you know, oh my God, it's all toxic now. We must go. But we pray, we're protected because we're in service of our spiritual master, of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Lord Chaitanya Lord Nityananda. That will protect us. Otherwise, you know, we permanently have to close those rooms of the guest house, right? And say, no one can stay there anymore. You can't sacrifice our devotees, you know. You come to the Dham and you got a room in the guest house, number 10. Yeah. We are protected, but only when we're in the service of Lord Chaitanya. When we go there out of curiosity ourselves, you know, that's, you know, I mean, I kind of like the riffs, you know, some good ragas, let me record that, you know, then you just kind of step over the line of service, and then the toxic effect will suddenly hit us. You have to. Well, you hear it in 8, in 9 it's louder, and it goes to number 13, and 12 is louder. 8 to 12 is very loud. One floor up is you can also hear it, but it's less. Yeah, so you know, there's still two floors above, but those haven't memorized those numbers. 22 is the one above ten. Yeah. Anyway, you can't get a room in the guest house anyway. it's already booked out. Good. Any other question? Philosophy.
You explained about, you know, digging in the different directions for the treasure. Mm. Can you explain why is the West the Jnani? Why it's been haunted like a ghost, and why the relationship?
Yeah, I didn't fully explain it, but the West, the ghost of impersonalism, is. In the North, there's a big snake. You get all these mystic powers. You become more powerful than everyone else. And that is, of course, it becomes something very intoxicating and obsessing the mind. If you go towards impersonalism, because it's the last snare of Maya, right? Here, we, in the name of giving up the ego, we're getting the biggest ego, namely, I am God. Now, if that's an ego trip, right? So therefore the last snare of Maya, right? We want to be great, and we're the greatest, we're the ultimate. Tatram asi, I am that too. Very exciting. So it becomes very, it deals with the root cause of our existence in the material world, that we are in competition with Krishna. So now we are fulfilling that root desire. Therefore, it's very deep and very strong. So the South represents, and it's interesting that the impersonalism is in the West. Yeah, and in Western countries, you find plenty of impersonalism, actually. Yeah. For example, when science gained more ground, Christianity took the second position and became impersonal. So actually, this whole idea of a God and heavens, that's all anthropomorphism. That is just projection for simple people. But the real thing is, God is all-pervading. He's all-pervading love. Then it's impersonalism. So impersonalism is everywhere. Pashyate desha tarine, to deliver the Western countries of impersonalism. The hippie movement was all based on impersonalism. Aldous Huxley was an impersonalist. Then books like On the Road, Jack Kerouac, some of the hippie prophets, or Buddhism, impersonalism was rampant. So all the great personalities, all the hippies were impersonalists. So this movement started out with impersonalists.
But why has that been related to the haunting by a ghost?
Because it possesses you, a ghost. Being haunted by a ghost means you become possessed. And you cannot think of anything else. Everything else is pushed out of the mind. So one becomes possessed in that way. The drones in the south are referring to Karmakanda, Peter Puck. Yeah, and all those kinds of varieties. I heard that Peter Puck is in season once again. And here we go. You know, all that is wasps and drones. We are just looking for temporary benefit from our so-called spiritual activities. And in this way, we've satisfied our need for spirituality. We do all the ritual, but it's just for temporary gain, and we miss the real purpose, the real goal. And all what we gain, we will lose anyway with time, and therefore we just get stung by them. And each thing has so many side effects. Mercedes-Benz, it's the greatest car in the world, until you drive it into the garage. And just for looking at the car, they charge you, you know, with 3 zeros and put any number in front. So like this, how much enjoyment? It's a network of entanglement. Those are the wasps and drones. Other questions? Yes. Yeah, go ahead.
I was trying to understand, in the Prabhupada is mentioning that unpretentiousness also means serving for the pleasure of Krishna.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're trying to serve for the pleasure of Krishna, I'm trying to understand this point about being detached from the results of service. Because sometimes if, say, something doesn't work in a service, then to what degree am I supposed to like be detached and say, okay, Krishna wants it this way? To what degree am I supposed to like, okay, how can we do it better?
First of all, in the Madhurya Kadambini, Śrīla Viśvanātha Cakravarti Thakura is describing Taranga Ranjini, and that we're starting to enjoy the side benefits from devotional service. Like the prestige we are getting, the facility that we are getting as service is being performed, and as we're getting more responsibility in service. So recognition also comes with it, and one can easily lose the goal of devotional service, the pure goal, that it's for the satisfaction of Krishna only. There are other ways one can use the philosophy of Krishna consciousness to be soft on oneself. For example, what if Srila Prabhupada would have done that? He would have come to the Western world and he tried to spread Krishna consciousness. It didn't work. And he would have gone back on the boat and would have said, doesn't work. People in the West are just not receptive to devotional service. What if he would have given up? But one of Prabhupada's qualities is that he left no stone unturned. Right? He just let no opportunity go by. He would just not give up. It's just shocking. When his manuscript gets stolen of the Bhagavad Gita, almost done, you know, starts again. I mean, it's just like, it's just, who has that, you know? We, when a few times it doesn't work, then we say, maybe Krishna doesn't want it. I think so. But Prabhupada just founded himself in the order of his spiritual master. Said, no, it's the order of my spiritual master. That is Krishna's will, and therefore I will do. No matter what. And I will not come up with any material excuse. I'll do the best I can. Of course, just like that brahmana who was illiterate, who could not read and got the order to read, but he could not read. So, you know, he tried to do the best he can, sit there with the book, but still he could not read. And so the order was taller than what he could execute, but he tried. And for trying, he got all the mercy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So Sometimes the order of the spiritual master may be taller than we are, but still we should try. We should never give up and think, oh, Krishna doesn't want it. Too much opposition. Cop out. So there are different ways that we can, in devotional service, deviate from that real purpose, the satisfaction of Krishna, satisfaction of Guru and Krishna. It wasn't Lord Chaitanya who gave the order. It was the Guru who gave the order. Ask the Guru. I didn't give that order. You have to ask that Guru. But we can, of course, come up with some logical answer, which would make sense. We could say, to push that disciple to go really like to his two limits. He was an illiterate brahmana. You don't get off so light. If you're a brahmana, you cannot just be illiterate. So you must study. That is the duty of a brahmana. But can't read, study anyway. Anyway, he saw the picture of Krishna being the chariot driver of Arjuna. He appreciated that the Lord became the servant of his devotee. He cried tears. For that, Lord Chaitanya declared him the greatest pandit, the greatest scholar of the Bhagavad Gita. So he got the essence because he sincerely tried. And then there was Krishna reciprocated. So it showed also that by sincerely trying anyway, he got the mercy of Krishna. And the spiritual master, he didn't let him off. He didn't say, well, you know, you're a brahmana, but you can't read. No. So it's the duty of a brahmana to study scripture. You must study scripture. He didn't let him off. So the spiritual master sometimes may give us a general instruction and we think, why is he giving me a general instruction? What did I get a spiritual master for? I wanted the personal instruction, the general instruction. I could have gotten it from the scripture or from anywhere. Is that all he's going to say to me? Just a general instruction? Yes. But if we stick to that general instruction, if we take it very serious, because it's the order of our spiritual master, then the Lord will reciprocate.
Okay. Just on the point of when doing devotional service, then the side effects come, like prestige and adoration. And what should our attitude be towards when these things come?
Bhagavad Gita says, Purusan Nisu. It is said that I am the ability in men. We all have some ability, you know, and everybody is better at something than somebody else. And you know it when you're better at something than someone else. And, you know, you can't act as if you're not better. Although you may not be always better. Krishna may show you that also. But Purusam Nisu means that I am the ability in men. So we should understand that if we have any ability, that it's a gift from Krishna. Krishna's given me this gift. That's all. And he can take it away whenever he likes. Just like that. He gives and takes. I always give the example, Beethoven became deaf. Can you imagine? Ta-da-da-da. Yeah. So what a situation, what a tragedy, you know? It was amazing. But what a lesson also. Purna musikabhav, you know. Be a mouse again. Become too proud, you'll become a mouse. So the whole mechanism of karma is like based on purna musikabhav, be a mouse again. So if we don't ourselves realize that Krishna is the one who gives us these abilities, then the mechanism kicks in, which will eventually pull us down. The mechanism of karma will just bring us down, be a mouse again.
Not being pretentious means to serve for Krishna's pleasure.
and I've been doing the service of model of instruction by my spiritual master, and I'm not happy in that, trying to do it.
Yeah.
I want to change, or just that emotion of being unhappy or not satisfied, is that showing that I'm pretentious? Or is it as simple as that, or is it?
Yeah, I think so. I think it is. I think it's as simple as that. No, I remember myself that previously I was a disciple of Bhavananda Prabhu, who could be quite absolute. And I remember that I was doing a little service in Mayapur, helping with the organization of the festival, and I was building a small little shed. Suddenly Bhavananda stands behind me, and I felt something ominous and something kind of intense. And he just said, "So you like construction?" And my mind was racing, and I was thinking, how can I get out of this? I saw it coming. I said, "No, not really. I'd rather do some preaching." He said, "Great. You're in charge of all construction in Mayapur." And he turned away and walked. He turned around and walked away. And I fell in a black hole right there and then, because it was the last thing I wanted to do. Now, then after some time he fell down. So then I was thinking, maybe now I can finally escape from this from this order, right? But then I was thinking, no, but it was a bona fide order. I cannot just give it up so lightly. It was a bona fide order. So I didn't give it up, although it was known that he was actually having problems. Then the GBC passed a resolution that and relieved him of this responsibility. Then I thought to myself, maybe now I can escape from this. And then I was thinking, yes, but so now I'm here in this service and I can't just drop it. Then the GVC decided that Hari Sori should finish the Samadhi. I thought, now this is my chance. Now I'm free. Now I can run away from this service because I hated it. Yeah? I hated it. Construction. Got it. I hate it. So now I can run away. And then I wrote a letter of resignation. And I thought, let me be decent and let me give it. Before I give it to the GBC, let me give it to Hari Sori. Yeah? Like, you know. And I went to Hari Sori, and I came to his room, and I said, "Hari Sori Prabhu, I wanted to talk to you." He said, "Yes, yes, go ahead." He was packing his bag, right? And so he just kept on packing, and then I said, "Actually, I'm resigning. I have my resignation letter here." He said, "Give it to the GBC." I said, "Well, I wanted to give it to you first, you know." He said, "No, that's not necessary, because I am leaving." He was more experienced than me. He knew you just leave first and resign after. So then I still had the samadhi. I still did the samadhi after that, because I still felt I can't run away from this, because this order came to me. And so the order of the spiritual master is very serious. Even after he had left, it was still something. I had no excuse. And although I didn't like it at all, I had to do it as an austerity. So yes, it's pretentious if we... because we're more attached to the service than to pleasing Krishna. I like this service, I don't like that service. You see? No? It's the pleasure of Krishna that counts. And the Vaishnavas are the superior Vaishnavas, they have superior intelligence and they may want to use an aspect of us that we don't like to use ourselves. We may like to use another side. Like, for example, I'd rather be a singer. Yeah? Yeah, I mean, I've been building samadhis. If I can choose, I'd rather sing than build samadhis. But anyway, they were not interested in me as a singer at that time.
But you're putting that devotee against the current. If a devotee is
maybe good for him.
Happy in that situation, you know, it's like he's swimming against the current.
Yeah, well, for his purification and for the interest of the movement. Sometimes someone has to swim against the current. It's difficult though, and therefore spiritual masters are sensitive to psychophysical nature of devotees and generally consider their inclinations. And also, if someone has a talent, then obviously they do that service also nicely. I mean, in one temple we had one devotee, he really wanted to cook, and every day he would churn out a dozen horrible preparations. Yeah? So, you know, that person was not properly engaged. So we engage people according to their abilities and talents and so on, but not always. Especially managers many times feel that, like, why do I have to do all this? Because management is a thankless task. Right? You get criticized by everyone. There are 100 problems. You rise to the occasions of trying to deal with them. You're solving 10 of them. And instead of saying, oh, how nice that you solved these 10 problems, people say, why are these 90 problems here? You're not doing anything to solve the problems here. We have so many problems. Meanwhile, you solve 10 problems. It's a very tough job, management. Problems. That's what you have to deal with. Problems. How many times have I stood side by side with the police next to a dead body? Right? They call us, you know, when there's trouble. People came to leave their bodies, or there were accidents, something. And they call always the management to stand there with the emergency services. Trouble. But if we all, Jayadvaita Maharaj, who's good with one-liners, he once said, if everyone in this movement would do what would follow their propensity, then ISKCON would be one big band with a few roadies. Put that one under your belt. Shall we end on a high note? Thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.
Jai Sri Ram Kalamaraji.